Mugraga Danganhu, Law Dawakahu, Ekyanti and Varagi, Hugmahu Laragut, Hugmakri Tanavut, Daily Sumkharadlat, His Father Valulat, His Dusa Norivatrach, Khrish Parlu Saw Yalagum, Rurnana Omnakagum, Baku Saw Yargagum, Briki Og Gapagum, Rosta Ervaravum, Mart Al Yagagum, Kulla Gluv Lachandum, Gudiachan Tatra, Maharish Dodanachlum.
My steadfast love, when I saw you one day by the market house gable, my eye gave a look, my heart shone out. I fled with you far from friends and home, and never was sorry. You had parlours painted, rooms decked out, and ovens reddened, and loaves made up, roasts on spits, and cattle slaughtered. I slept in Duckdown till noon time came, or later if I liked.
Is Irik Susid Hassif, Is Tarlum Fenavala, Gugurum Marta Lega, Gung Lemer Kosher Arshing, Gumayagang Kiola Sprega, Gugoro Dichilaba, Fe Varlini Gala, Fe Chultina Braha Breca, Awani Asad Alish, in Onodonucht of Lachish.
My steadfast love, arise, stand up, and come with myself, and I'll have cattle slaughtered, and call fine company, and hurry up the music. And make you up a bed with bright sheets upon it and fine speckled quilts to bring you out in a sweat where the cold has caught you.
Hi gang, hope you're all happy and healthy as can be. Would you believe it? Episode 150 is coming up and it's going to be a mailbag special. We would absolutely love to hear from you for this. If you'd like to take part, please send us a voice note on WhatsApp at the following number, +353 89 478 4713. You never know, we might include it and discuss it on the show. You can also find a link in the show notes. And now for the show.
From the Head Stuff Podcast Network, welcome to Motherfuck Lore, a podcast of words, Irish. Irish words and words from Ireland. I am beloved pod dad, author, columnist, Darragh O'Shea.
I'm Patrick O'Ronick.
I'm sometime contributor, Geraldine McAvoy, from the cupboard, from Narnia. I refuse to describe myself.
Don't give in to the hype. Mm-hmm. Don't give in to the hype.
I wasn't prepared to describe myself.
Sometimes you just need to drag yourself out of the depths of misery and just remind yourself you've occasionally accomplished things.
All right, on occasion.
I'm living vicariously through your podcast, so no, I'm not going to subscribe to that.
Very well. It is. There's weeks and there's days, and you know they say was days are long and years are short, but it feels like it's been a long few months and years. But one of the things that's been cheering me up, and hopefully lots of you up, is that there's an awful lot of good stuff coming out at the moment. In particular, September and October in Ireland are big months for the books that want to be considered for the Irish Book Awards and for the Christmas market. All get released in one go. There's a slew of really interesting art books coming out at the moment.
The books want to be considered for awards, do they?
They do.
They just look up at you and they look, author, can you please consider me for an award?
Well, that too. I mean, I think generally there's a rush towards in early December. The Irish Book Awards happen, and the books that tend to be considered for it are, like I'd say, maybe 75% of them are released in the previous 2 months.
I did not know that, but that makes perfect sense. You always get one that in your stocking, don't you, from an aunt or something that has a sticker on it, considered for whatever prize, you know?
It's like Oscar season then, is it? Yeah. It's like when they release films towards the end of the year, not just to get the Christmas market, but so there's a buzz about them in the run-up to the Oscars.
This is it. And this is why they say that maybe they should have a summer Oscars and a winter Oscars, so that they spread out the good films throughout the year. Because it's terrible that all the kind of high quality dramas are competing with each other, whereas you'd be grateful of some of them earlier on in the year.
But yeah, all you get during the summer is those rom-coms and Marvel films.
Yeah, oh, yeah, summer blockbusters.
So, there's the term, yeah.
He was a man. She was a woman.
Oh my God, amazing. Fund it now. Give it all of the money right now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, get this. She's a woman. She's very interested in her career. And then she meets a rascally lad. And then she realizes, oh, maybe my career isn't everything. Maybe I should settle down and produce children for this man. It was
starring
called
Catholicism.
And Paul ding, Rudd. Ding. I love Paul Rudd, though. I would watch anything with Paul Rudd in it.
Yeah.
I would watch
like Catherine Hegel as well.
Yeah, I would probably watch Paul Rudd and Catherine Hegel reading cereal boxes.
Well,
yeah, they'd have great chemistry, I'd say.
I do think 27 Dresses is underrated. It got a lot of criticism at the time for the old obsession with weddings, but I think it's an entertaining film compared to some other, like, and I think, you know, because rom-com, the outcomes are predetermined, the actual writing has to be good to keep you interested.
Is 27 Dresses the one with your man who pretends to be Irish that time, the Scottish fella?
Is that not Yes, I Love You?
No, you're thinking of The Perfect Match.
Oh, that's not awful.
No, The Perfect Match is the one with Jimmy Fallon. Sorry, the one with Jared Butler and Catherine Hegel.
Isn't that The Perfect Catch with Jimmy Fallon?
Oh, yes, that's how.
6 months later.
I would watch a rom-com where Gerard Butler was dead the whole time.
Isn't that the opposite of the point of P.S. I Love You? No, that is P.S. I Love You, isn't it?
Oh, yes,
I Love You. Oh my God.
He's dead in P.S. I Love You.
That's
Hello, me darling. Me and me stupid accent are brown bread.
Do you know what I hate most about it? Do you know what my least favourite? I watched it one time. Only one time, because that's a mistake you only make once. And at the very end of it, she goes off to Ireland with her mum, maybe.
Yeah.
And like they go to some farm and there's a farmer on the farm, and so obviously, and somebody, I think it's her mom, drops a box of chocolates, and he goes, "Oh, you dropped your sweets," and I hate it. I don't know what it is, but I hate it so much. I don't know why I hate that particular scene.
It sounds like slime for something, doesn't it?
Oh, it just makes my skin crawl. I hate it. I hate it so much. Awful. Oh.
So, instead of romantic comedies of this nature, you'd be more interested in a powerful, intense, female perspective, dramatic love poem.
Yeah, revenge fantasy. That's what
revenge
I want.
Revenge fantasy love poem.
Yeah.
From a formidable woman who has a rivalry with her husband's sister.
Yeah, I'm into that. I'm down with that. But a formidable woman from the perspective of a woman, not a formidable woman like men who write romantic novels, write formidable women. Do you know those kind of like formidable women?
Oh, yeah,
women?
Yeah. The ones who she breasted boobily down the stairs.
Those women, yeah. Formidable. You know, not a manic pixie dream girl. She does not have large eyes and didn't know she was beautiful, but is conventionally righty. Not like, what's that movie where she takes down her hair and takes off her glasses and everyone's like, wow, she's beautiful.
It's all movies. That's all the films.
Yeah, so not that film, but the one where she takes control of the narrative. I'm into that.
And this is one of the things we're going to be talking about today. As I mentioned at the top there, there's a lot of interesting books at the moment. Perhaps none more exciting than Dearnay Griffith's new book called A Ghost in the Throat, which deals with the author's, fascination with the poem Cuíonach Ar Do Laoghaire. Cuíonach Ar Do Laoghaire, The Lament of Ar Do Laoghaire, as it's sometimes translated, and her journey to discover who this woman was who wrote this poem, regarded by many as the greatest in the English or Irish in the 18th century. And in the very beginning of the book, she comes up with the opening line is, this is a female text. It is not, the ferocity of this woman is not there to thrill and titillate dudes. And she's not like a conquest. She is telling a story from her own perspective, the whole gamut of feelings. Gairdín, what is Cuíonach Ar Do Laoghaire?
Yeah, well, the Cuíonach is this, you say it's like, it's a poem in a sense, it's not written, it's from the oral tradition, and the way that it would have been traditionally passed on was by word of mouth. I think it wasn't written, or at least the first cataloguing of it wasn't until like 30 years after it was initially composed by the protagonist in the poem, Eileen Dove. And it's a poem about, so this is the wife of a fairly famous at the time man, an outlaw who lived in Cork, and they lived outside Macroom, Eileen and Art. And it's a story of a murder and of death and of heartbreak and loss, and then also revenge. And then you have these themes of, it's a really long poem. It's like 5 stages in it, and it has themes of like conflict between 2 families, because these were 2 kind of star-crossed lovers who weren't supposed to be together, and their families didn't agree with them being together, but fell in love. And then Art O'Leary had gotten in a row, shall we say, with a Brit, and he ended up getting killed. And it's this really dramatic story where this horse arrives without a rider to Eileen Dove's house, and then she knows her husband has been killed, and she goes to see him, and she drinks his blood, and she demands revenge from the man who's murdered her husband. And yeah, so like we were saying, it's a really profound poem, because, you know, Ireland has this tradition of like famous writers, and like we're known for our literary tradition, but they're all men, right? You know, when you talk about Irish literary greats, you talk about Joyce, you talk about Beckett, you talk about Yeats, you know, and they're all wonderful in their own way. Well, except Yeats, who, you know, notified creep. And we've talked about that before, guys. You know, they've all got this fame. And then there's this, probably one of the, like you said, one of the most famous poems of that time, written, or shall we say, performed by a woman from the perspective of a woman about her feelings. So you have so many stories of heartbroken women, right? It's the story of a heartbroken woman isn't new, of a woman who's had her lover taken from her, and her being sad about that. But this is in such a raw way. I find it so wonderful, because you have, not only is she heartbroken, she's angry. She's so, so angry at what has happened. And she's distraught by that anger. And it's raw and it's pure. And it's not in this sort of twee, dainty little, oh, I'm going to faint at the sight of blood. No, Eileen Dove's like, I'm drinking that blood because I'm a hardcore bitch. And Morris, I'm coming for me. Like, you better watch your back, Morris, essentially. That's the guy who killed her husband.
Oh, Morris.
Yeah. Morris, get in the bin.
Yeah, it was Peter Levi, who was the professor of poetry at Oxford University, who said that it was the single greatest love poem written in these islands, meaning Britain and Ireland, in the last 200 years when he said it. And it is, I mean, raw doesn't come anywhere near describing the sheer passion, sheer unbridled passion. And I suppose the one thing that you need to consider is that medieval Irish poetry, the great Irish poetic tradition, the female voice and the female gaze was not a unique concept, because poets would often write tributes to their local petty kings or chieftains, and they would write it from the point of view of the land, and the king was the husband of the land. So you end up with great medieval poetry like Avrin O'Rourke, Moroa Lanon, Brian O'Rourke, My Choice of Lovers. Those are things written by male poets, but from a female point of view. But this one, written as it was in the 18th century after the fall of the Gaelic aristocracy, so you didn't have these caste poets anymore. You know, anybody could be a poet. You didn't have to be an O'Higgian or an O'Rahilla. Anybody could be a poet. So Eileen Dove wrote this poem, and yes, it's from the female point of view, and it's indicative of the female gaze, but it's actually real. It's not pretend in the slightest. It's real. She genuinely, madly and truly loved Art O'Leary. She had an arranged marriage when she was 15, and he barely lasted 6 months. He died. And so she married again. She fell in love with Art O'Leary. She was 23 or 24. He was 20. And she just said, I'm having a bit of that. Yet it was a tremendous love, a huge, massive disagreement from her family. Muintirí Cunnell of Derrynane in County Kerry, this is fucking royalty. Like Eileen Dubney Cunnell is an aunt of Daniel O'Connell. Like, these are some of the most important people in that part of the country at the time. So she's, from ridiculously good family. And she falls in love with this guy who's a fucking outlaw. Like, Arthur Leary, who was a captain in the Hungarian Hussars, and was basically off gallivanting across Europe fighting in other people's wars because he was an adventurer. Yeah. And, you know, it was very much disapproved of, but Jesus, she loved the bones of him. And when he was eventually killed, you just get that raw passion in what she has to say. And this is a sexy poem. I know he's dead, so it's kind of weird, but this is a very, very sexy poem.
It is. Yeah, there's anger, there's pain, there's love, there's horn. Like, it's a wild ride. And, like, it was censored as well for because some of the people who initially wrote it were members of the clergy. And they were like, oh, that's too sexy. Got to take some of it out. So you know you're doing well when the clergy are like, absolutely not.
they read the poem, they enjoy it, and they say, oh, no one else can enjoy that.
Yeah.
No one else can.
I've read it. I've had
no one else can read.
Now I'm going to censor censor all the boobs and willies and all of the rest of it.
Yeah. The muscles rippling under his Hungarian officer uniform as he rode through town upon a horse that resembled him.
I think my favourite part of the fact that her family weren't into it, I like to tell, yes, he was a nobody essentially, or a fella off. He's the guy in, what's that song? Oh my God, the Wild Rover. Oh, yeah. He's your man in the Wild Rover, the son who goes away. Yeah. Hmm. He's a general pup and all the women are mad about him because he's a big ride. But I think my favourite interpretation of that is her family are from Kerry, he's from Cork. And they're like, absolutely not. No, she's not marrying a man from Cork. He's from where? McCrill? Absolutely.
Do you know what they do in Cork? Do you know what they do in Cork? They boil drisheen in milk and tripe and eat sheep's stomachs turned inside out.
Derek, we need to have an intervention with you, particularly. Not content with riling up people of Dublin over a coddle, you bring wrath upon the people of Cork for drisheen. Okay, I won't have it. I won't have this disrespect.
It's true. I mentioned drisheen on Twitter on Wednesday morning, just casually came up in conversation, and that afternoon Cork people made me deactivate the account.
I love how he says casually came up in conversation, as though he didn't start it. Like, as though you didn't fire the first shot.
Derek has force-fed more people drisheen and coddle than anybody in Dublin or Cork could ever have wanted.
I just have to, one of your responsibilities as a podcaster is, to tell the truth, hold a mirror up that to the world, let them realise what they're really like, and they are boiled in weird thick soup.
Derek, have you had drisheen?
Yes.
And?
Not really. I prefer black pudding.
Yeah, it's fucking manky, isn't it?
I swear, the next time we do a live show in Cork, there's going to be a mob outside the English Market. They're going to have their O'Flynn sausages and pudding on top of Pikes waiting for us. It's going to be your fault.
Actually, I'm down for that, because the last time we did a live show in Cork, I made sure to turn up in Cork early so I could get to the English Market and have an O'Flynn sausage, because it's actually worth the journey. So I'm down for that. So long as they keep their crew beans and their drisheen away from me. That's it. But look, I don't think it was anything to do. Like, it wasn't about what Art O'Leary ate. The thing is, like, the O'Connells of Derry Nan were on the up. They were the rising stock in the area. Daniel O'Connell, of course, being the most famous of them, one generation after Eileen Dove and her 21 brothers and sisters. But the thing about it is, she was supposed to marry, she was originally married to an O'Connor from Fire East. She was supposed to marry one of the good families to help the O'Connells, to help them rise in the world. And instead she fell in love with this guy who's from the old aristocracy. He's one of the O'Learys, the old kings, and they're just there, the past.
Yeah.
They're nothing to do with the future. They're not parliamentarians. He's still off fighting for Catholic armies across Europe. He's not getting with the program, running for parliament and trying to repeal the penal laws. He's off fucking shooting his musket all over Hungary. Like, this guy is not the future. But my God, was he a ride.
Is that a line in the poem, shooting his musket all over Europe?
That's it. Yeah. Fucking the fifth stanza.
So like what it all came to is when he had returned and the penal laws are in place, and many of these laws, and the fact that they were called the penal laws is interesting, that generally speaking, most countries, the idea is with most countries and their legal systems, there's a presumption of fairness, and that the people enforcing the laws like to imply that they're based on some sort of reason. But the penal laws were almost, the way they were written, they almost expected people to break them, and they were written in a tone as, this is what happens if you break this law, or when you break this law. They were intentionally unfair. And one of the ways...
Yeah, they were there to subjugate Catholics. Like that was the idea. It was to subjugate Catholics, because at the time the vast majority of Gaelic Irish were Catholics, and the vast majority of those who were in support of the Crown forces were not. They were Protestant. So you ended up having penal laws that would mean that no Catholic could hold the office of magistrate. No Catholic could be a lawyer. Catholics had to split up all of their property between all living children, as opposed to the Protestants, who were allowed to pass it along on lines of primogeniture to one person so that the estates could remain intact. Mm-hmm. And tellingly for this story, no Catholic was allowed to own a horse valued at over £5. So when Art O'Leary comes back from the wars on his fine Hungarian cavalry steed, and like, bear in mind, a military horse, a destrier as they're known, those were the fucking Ferraris of their day. Like, a rich man would own a horse, but I mean, this was a weapon of war. This was the finest horse. This horse was trained as a soldier and had saved O'Leary's life on more than one occasion. Like, this horse could, it could do mad shit for horses. But of course, because no Catholic is allowed to own a horse worth more than a fiver, the local sheriff, Abraham Morris, went along and demanded that O'Leary sell him the horse for a fiver, because it couldn't be worth any more. So, you know, O'Leary declined, and he actually challenged Morris to a duel. And Morris declined the duel because he was a coward. And then he persuaded his fellow magistrates to proclaim O'Leary an outlaw who could be legally shot on sight, tracked him down with a bunch of soldiers. O'Leary went on the run, took to the hills, but they caught up with him at Carriganimma on the 4th of May, 1773, and Morris gave the order to fire. The first shot, the shot that killed Art O'Leary, was fired by a soldier called Private Green. So a coroner found Morris and the soldiers guilty, but he submitted himself for a trial among the Cork magistrates, of which he was one. And of course, because no Irish Catholic could be a magistrate or a lawyer, he was found not guilty, which is just...
Of course
just,
he was. Course he went to court among his mates. Like, yeah. They're all like, no, that was grand. Yeah, did you get the horse?
So in this sense, you could almost see Queen of Art O'Leary as an ancestor of Fuck the Police and other rap songs about injustice like that.
If Fuck the Police had a verse or two about riding, I mean, does it? I don't know.
I don't know the lyrics to it. Mm-hmm. I couldn't tell you. But does it have a verse about drinking blood? I mean, I'm not sure.
It is all the poorer for not having it.
Yeah. Doesn't that story make you wonder? Again, we've said it like a million times on this, but like, man, that'd make a great film. Like, what, a summer blockbuster? Hello? Like, that'd be a great one. I'd go and see that.
It's a great play.
Yeah.
When Lisa Cohen was on this podcast last year, she actually used the very words that, well, she said was describing specifically Dearony Griffith's book, Ghost in the Throat. And she said it was Notes to Self meets Poldark, was how she pitched it, while also mentioning she did that Dearon didn't approve of that description.
Did you ever read Queen of Art O'Leary in school?
Did I ever? It's freaking awesome.
Sure,
my son is partly named after it.
Oh, of course he is. Mm-hmm.
Him and Art Spiegelman as well.
Oh, beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Artin Beg.
Artin Beg.
On Loch. Dearnie Grifa, a very accomplished poet, a member of Eastona, winner of many awards, has written a prose book, her first. And it's about how she was a bit obsessed with the poem, The Lament for Art O'Leary. For anybody who doesn't know it, I would absolutely Google it. It's really metal, really exciting. It is... horse gallops to the door, woman hops on the horse, brings her to her dead husband. He's been shot by the dreaded Brits, and she falls to her knees, drinks his blood in handfuls, and composes an epic poem about her love for him and how sexy he was and how intertwined they were. And it's fresh and exciting, and so this is 18th century. Dearn got really interested in this poem, and she, as a poet, encounters this other woman who is a poet. And it kind of makes her think about her own writing process and what she's trying to achieve. She becomes obsessed with Eileen Dúna Chenil, who wrote it, because we know her through the men in her life. We know her about, you know, because she's married to Art. We know that she was Daniel O'Connell's auntie. We can find evidence of her sons and grandsons' lives, but the knowledge around her kind of drops off in her later life. So Dearn becomes obsessed with tracking her down and finding her voice and sort of bringing it back. She embarks on translating the poem as she goes as well. And so the question, it's a bit of a detective story. Does she find her, and what happens along the way? And I am very crude, and I don't think Dearn will appreciate my saying this, but I've been telling people it's like Notes to Self meets Paul Dark.
Oh, wow.
It's beautiful. It's dramatic, exciting. You don't have to speak a word of Irish. She talks about it, but she'll refer to stuff, but everything's in English, and she will talk about problems around Irish words in it. There's a few phrases, Trireilge, but context is explained and everything. So you could give this as a gift, but I think it is a thrilling, exciting book, and that's going to be early 2020.
But it definitely, I mean, the amount of drama and passion and rivalries in this story. You know, you have this woman with this rivalry with his family, with his love of this man, love of the horse, and as well as her, she was pregnant at the time as well when he had died. She's carrying his child. And then Morrison Green were marching around the town like cock of the walk. You know, these things unlikely to end well. There's just, it has the makings of a great film or a great soap opera.
Yeah. But it's just so wonderful that, like, it's unfortunate. I know this is the reason why Dearn the Griefer wrote her book, but, like, if you Google anything, if you research Eileen Dove, it's all about, like, even before we came on, I just scanned through her Wikipedia page, and about 70% of it is about Artie Lira. And, like, yes, this is what she's known for. She wrote a poem about her. She created a poem about her love dying and the man she loved so, so deeply and was so passionate about. But her voice somehow gets a little bit lost in the way we talk about it, which is really unfortunate. And I haven't read Ghosts and Throat yet. I was saying earlier, I'm still in that stage where I feel guilty about leisure reading. So I haven't gotten to it yet. But I'm so glad that it exists, that people are realising that, you know, this woman's, unfortunately, because of the society we live in, even though we have this woman who poured her heart and soul onto this poem, we somehow still get preoccupied with the story that she's telling or the man that she's talking about. And yes, she's inherently connected to that, but she's a person in herself. And, you know, she's so defined by, I think Lisa Cohen said it, she's so defined by the men in her life, by being Daniel O'Connell's aunt and being Artie Lear's wife, and being that, like, scorned lover and, like, hell hath no fury like Eileen Dove, and that's grand. I'm okay with that.
This is something that keeps coming up, and we've mentioned this before on one of our live events. It's very hard to find it. Anytime you look up information on Maud Gonne, who had a very eventful life, did a lot of interesting stuff, was a character in her own right, inevitably a guy who she didn't really want to have that much to do with. They had a kind of a friendship, but his name keeps popping up in the story of her life. He is the poet. You may have heard of W.B. Yeats, but I mean, the idea is you can read a lot about Yeats without hearing about the women in his life necessarily. Whereas it seems every sentence about Maud Gonne, this boy turns up and he has like projected his himself on onto her life, posthumously, that she can't, her story can't be told, that him turning up, it's not something she ever asked for, and it's very frustrating. Similarly, there is a lot of women who are very, have a very important lives. Hilda Moriarty, one of the first women to actually, or one of the first Catholic women to study medicine in Ireland, and was very successful. Any story about her always turns into a story about Paddy Kavanagh.
Yeah. Fucking poets, man.
Poets, man.
They don't ever even leave women alone.
And
thankfully, Arthur O'Leary wasn't the poet. Eileen Dove was. And and the one thing that makes that Mark Serret is different is, like, we don't have, like, it's so crazy. We don't have a portrait of her, right? She was very well known, but nobody ever thought to get her to sit for a portrait. We have pictures of Arthur O'Leary. We know how handsome he was, but we don't have a portrait of Eileen Dove. But we have her words. And we have what she wrote, and it is immortal, and it is forever that we have this. And we have it, amazingly, some people say that it's because of professional keeners, Manal Cuinte, in the late 1790s, early 1800s, that they kept this poem alive. And there was a scribe and a poet called Eamon Duval, and he met a keener, a band Cuinte called Nora Ní Hiondaile from Mill Street, just down the road from Macroom, and that she had preserved the poem, and he transcribed it. He was the first one to write it down, but it's Eileen's words. And we don't have that for so many of these women that get erased from history or just get folded into these stories of men. Like, you're right about Maud Gonne. You know what my favorite Maud Gonne fact is that has nothing to do with Yeats?
She, is it the monkey fact?
No, she and her friend Charlotte Despard were really active in feeding the homeless in Dublin, and particularly in and around the 1913 lockout and the likes. Yeah. But of course, you know, in Dublin, we'll give anything a nickname. So their nicknames, Charlotte Despard and Maud Gonne, their nicknames were Charlotte Desperate and Maud Gonne Mad.
Hey,
waka waka.
Do you want to hear my favourite Maud Gonne story that I may have or may have not told already on the podcast?
Go for it.
Always.
Because she was a woman of a certain class, it was sort of deemed unsightly for women of the upper echelons of society to be out without an escort. And Maud Gonne was having none of that, so she got herself a little monkey that would sit on her shoulder, and that would be her escort. And there's a portrait of her with the monkey in Oris Nictaron.
Class.
This is, I think, when we talked, this came up, I think you mentioned this when we were doing a live show in Cork, which Cork keeps coming up today. And I think I remember the time I misunderstood that, because Yeats famously had an operation which involved monkey.
Yeats and monkey, that's not the story you think of, is it?
Yes. Yeats had an operation to basically have elements of monkey testicles, I initially thought they were installed, but they're actually injected, was what you were saying, Pater?
I wasn't saying anything about Yeats's monkey gland operation.
Yeats had a monkey gland operation. I'm not sure if that was inspired or not by the fact that Maud Gonne had a monkey close to her at all times.
This is why no one writes a righty poem about W.B. Yeats.
I hate to be Yeats's advocate in this, but like Oliver St. John Gogarty may be behind that story. And as a lot of people know, he fucking hated Yeats.
But listen, counterpoint may be deserved. Like, he was a big weirdo, as I said before on this podcast, definitely with clammy hands.
Well, Gogarty,
unfounded, but I'm saying it again.
Gogarty, it was also a was a troublesome figure as well. Obviously he had rivalries with Yeats and Joyce, and also I think he had sued Paddy Kavanagh for libel for, I think, in The Green Fool. I think Paddy Kavanagh alluded to the fact that he may have a mistress, and Gogarty sued him for £100. And the literary community in Dublin was so appalled, they invented a prize to give to Paddy Kavanagh that year for exactly that amount.
I thought it was Kavanagh took the libel action against Gogarty.
No. Kavanagh took a different libel action against against a journal in the mid 50s. There was a literary journal in Dublin in the 1950s, and in which they wrote a feature on Kavanagh about how he was a round dodger and a troublemaker, and and that he basically was they portrayed him in a very negative way, and poorly advised, he took them to court, and what they did is they got they pulled out the big guns and they got for their barrister the former Taoiseach is Costello, isn't it? Costello
was the one who took down John A. Costello.
Yeah, John A. Costello was the barrister that they brought in, and he demolished Kavanaugh in court. And he actually said that he probably should settle this out of court, because when I take him to court, I'm going to demolish him in public and everyone's going to feel sorry for him. Because he was that kind of guy. He was regarded as a lethally effective barrister. And he interrogated him for two days solid, knowing that Kavanaugh wouldn't be able to sit on the bench without a drink, without a refreshment for very long. And he, at one point, he said that he asked him if he was a friend of Brendan Behan, and Kavanaugh said, no, I had no time for that man. And then Costello produced a book, one of Kavanaugh's books, signed to my friend Brendan Behan on the day you helped me paint my house. Your friend, Paddy Kavanaugh.
I think what this is evidence that male poets are trash. And
Eileen
Dove doesn't get enough credit. Oh my God, they're all fucking terrible. They're all, pains in the hole. Paddy Kavanaugh, no one invited you to the dance? Maybe because you're weird. Oh my God.
Yeah, because you're like, your fingernails are covered in the stony grey soil of Monaghan. Just wash your fucking hands.
And stop sitting on the ditch staring at people going to Billy Brennan's bar. Stop that. Maybe they'll invite you if you stop gawking, weirdo.
No.
Just be normal and drink some fucking blood of the man you once loved. Yeah.
Just react to these disappointments in life in a normal way by drinking blood and swearing revenge.
But here's the thing, right? If Eileen Dove didn't get invited to the dance in Billy Brennan's barn, she wouldn't give a fuck, okay? Because she's too busy being cool and being class, drinking blood, swearing revenge against Morris. Did she ever get Morris in the end? What happened to him? He died soon. Didn't he die early or something?
Art's brother. So Art's brother was shot. Yes. Art's brother Con or Cornelius shot Morris. He saw Morris at the window of a house in Hammond's Lane in Cork City, and he shot three shots in through the window. Now, bear in mind, this was back at the time when you had to reload a pistol. It took nearly a minute to load a pistol back up again, and he shot him three fucking times through the window.
What's your man doing, just chilling at the window washing a cup or something?
I imagine the first shot put him down and Con wanted to make sure. But it's fairly certain that Eileen Dove was behind getting Cornelius to swear revenge.
And, I think.
Unfortunately, it didn't instantly kill Morris. He died 2 years later as a result of the wounds in the shooting.
I was going to say, Gargi makes an important forensic point in that the fact there's three bullets suggests that probably Con may have been carrying one or two guns, but maybe Eileen Dove was next to him with another gun, because your man wasn't standing around to be shot two more times after being shot once. He was probably crawling away. His buckshot, I think that if you had modern forensics at the time, you would have said there was two shooters.
There's never two shooters. Isn't that what they say?
Yeah, no. Occam's razor. He just shot him three times.
I feel like if you got shot in the gut or something, you know, you'd be I'm not running away from that. I don't know. You might be rolling around a little bit, but you'd still be in the general vicinity and have time to, I don't know how you load an old-timey gun. Like, do you have to shove powder into it or something?
Yeah, yeah.
Blow on it, say a prayer.
Shove a ball and powder into it. And,
yeah.
I don't know. Listen, I know that would make a great final scene of the movie, that Eileen Dove shot him, but like, I don't know. It's a bit, I don't want to be accusing her of murder.
I'd say she'd like it.
Listen, we know she had it in mind, and we know it was good enough for your man. But the fact he was shot three times and he didn't die on the spot, because I mean, if you think if he was shot and the person had time to load for two more times, he would have had time to crawl away if he wasn't injured that badly. If he was injured badly enough to not be able to move, the other two shots would have killed him.
Fucking LCSI motherfucker here.
I don't know. I'm worried about that kind of speculation now. But yeah, listen, he was shot three times anyway. And I like the fact that he suffered for 2 years. I think Eileen would have enjoyed that, you know.
See, I think...
Couldn't go out in the winter because he's like a hole in his tummy or something. I don't know.
She outlived him anyway. She outlived him by 25 years. And that's what's important here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's Jibs here from Pints of Malt. So our podcast is basically a group of Irish Nigerian lads who tell their stories, grown up in Ireland as well as Nigeria, and we share our experiences with all of y'all. We also add a bit of comedy as well, you know, to get y'all laughing, get y'all through the week in these tough times that we are in. So y'all sit back and just, you know, enjoy the show.
As Jib said, we're the Pints of Malt podcast. You can find us on all streaming platforms, including the Headstuff Network.
The poem. The poem. The poem. That's her legacy. Not revenge. Yeah. Not a dead magistrate called Abraham Morris, which is a bad guy's name if ever I heard.
Oh, absolutely.
You can imagine him twirling a moustache.
Yes, of course, because it was 1775. He may not have had a moustache. He definitely had a wig, though. He definitely powdered his face and wore a wig. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And used fucking lead to whiten his cheeks or something.
That could have been what killed him off early. Now you say that,
definitely.
As opposed to Art O'Leary, who just had like long dark hair and a moustache and was fucking gorgeous.
A big, massive outlaw, right?
Yeah.
Pouring around Cork on a big, nice, I'm assuming it was a black horse. It might be a black horse. It might not be a white horse in the poem.
I think she referred to it as the horse had a star on the forehead. And I think they just...
Yeah, it did, yeah.
So the legacy of this, as regarded as being this masterpiece of 18th century and something also that was kept alive by the caning tradition, which we mentioned last week's episode, What is this poetic legacy? What are the works it has influenced? What has this inspired in terms of the work since then? How has this been kept alive by Irish language scholarship, by other writers?
Well, so many ways. I mean, Hunter S. Thompson used an excerpt from the English translation in the Rum Diary. Mm-hmm. And he also, like, he uses it, like, this really, really influenced Thompson, because he keeps mentioning a location that doesn't exist, a fictional location, a street called Caia O'Leary, in his works, in the Rum Diary in particular. Apparently, Queen Artilera has influenced Brandán O'Madigan, Sean O'Reada, Padraig O'Reada, even Seamus Heaney's Burial at Thebes has similarities. There's a fantastic play by Tom McIntyre. It's an absolutely brilliant play, and it's Dá Hongach. It's in Ghaeilge agus in Mearla, in Irish and in English. And then, like, there's loads of little versions of it. Like, Dermot Bulger has a long poem called The Lament for Arthur Cleary, which makes numerous sort of soft and subtle references. And he turned that into a play as well. So there's a play called The Lament for Arthur Cleary. Of course, you mentioned A Ghost in the Throat by Deirdre Ní Gríofa, which is an homage. Like, she just talks about, it's very autobiographical, about how her own life intertwines with the life of Eileen Dove, and she seeks to find out more about Eileen Dove. There was a postmodern film adaptation, bilingual, that was done by Sinn Féin in 1975, with Sean Bon Branagh as Art O'Leary.
No way.
And SBB in a he, Mar Art O'Leary. And then there was a modern adaptation. The story was adapted by our good friend Manchán McGann. Was adapted for the screen as a short film called Boss Art O'Leary. And again, if you like, this just makes so much sense to me, because Art O'Leary, it's not very explicit, but it's fairly obvious from the film that Art O'Leary in this is a traveller. And if you want to recreate how bad the penal laws were against Gaelic Irish Catholics at the time, you just have to look at how travellers are treated today, to see how grim it was. So it stars Lachlan O'Maron as Art O'Leary. And again, he crosses a gangster. The gangster says, I'm going to buy your horse, and if you don't sell it to me, I'll kill you. And then he decides to kill him anyway. And it's again about the strong... Eileen Dove is the main character in it, and it's about her quest for revenge and how she's bathed in blood. And that was on TG Carr a couple of years ago. But yeah, that's so... I mean, look, this...
And people might recognise that actor.
Lachlan O'Maron, yeah, he's the guy from the Bord Bia commercials. He loves a bit of lamb.
Hot lamb dad,
yeah. I think this is the most important poem in Irish. I just think full stop, it is. Like, I had this poem as a reading at my wedding. Like, there's nothing more important. There are older poems. There are poems with perhaps more...
Sorry, I have a question. Did you have all of it, or was it just a bit of it?
First three stanzas.
Okay. Yeah, it's a love poem. Like, and it's not just like I love you, you're very nice and you have nice eyes. It's, I want to ride the bones off you, do you know? And that's the kind of love you want, isn't it?
But also, she keeps referring to him as her friend. not in a just good friends way, but in the suggestion that they're equal, that they're companions, that they chose each other, that she wasn't just, you know, she wasn't sold to him like an arranged marriage, like a piece of livestock.
Yeah, there was nothing transactional about it. It was this, like you said, it's equals. She was this powerful, headstrong woman, and he was this powerful, headstrong man, and together they were two peas in a pod. They were a pair, and then part of her was ripped away, and the pain she suffered and the love she had and continued to have for Artie Lyra. It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that opening stanza, it's just, there's nothing more powerful that's ever been written in Irish. Mm-hmm. And it shows exactly what their love was, that it was not transactional. It wasn't an arranged marriage. Mohraga dangantu, law da vakahu, ekyanti and varaki, hogmahul arachit, hogmakrik tanivchit, dalius omcharatlat, is fado valulat. My steadfast love, from the first day I saw you, by the market house gable end, my eye gave you a look, my heart shone out, and I fled with you far from my friends and my home.
It's so beautiful. It's so, so powerful. Like we were saying, like, we have great poets in Ireland and we have great poetry, but this is so overlooked. It's so, so good. Like, I'd recommend anyone to get hold of it. There's a really good book on Dúnra. It's Poems of the Dispossessed. Is it Sean O'Toole has written that one? Or did he?
He worked with Kinsella on that one. And
yeah. You can get it from Unshuppable Hour. I'm sure they have copies of it. But
also,
that contains Queen Artie Lyra with a translation also, if I'm not mistaken.
And Dúran's own translation of Queen Artie Lyra is at the back of Ghost in the Throat. And so, by all means, get your paws on that. We are hoping to get Dúran on the show before Christmas, as she's currently having an absolute rock star moment. So her availability has been trimmed accordingly. But
you've given it the kiss of death there. We'll never get her now.
No.
We hope it's never get her. We're still waiting to talk about the other fucking letters that aren't in the Gaelic alphabet. Like,
listen,
4 years later.
No, we started off. We did an episode on the letter V. We looked at the letter A and fathers. But the fact is, there's not that much to say with the letters X and Y. I mean, we could probably cover them in one particular episode. But rather than doing separate episodes in the letter X and J, is having an actual look at De Valdre's dictionary and how 1959, how there was procurement in typewriters. It just so happened the letters X and Y came into the Irish language and into the folklore the same year that the Irish Civil Service and other systems started using A4 paper, 1959.
Shit.
What?
It's bullshit. They were always in the Irish language. They just they got erased out of the Irish language at one stage.
But they were,
I think Pather has a good point
the
there.
The reintroduction was linked to procurement.
That is fucking fascinating. That's tell me more stories of the civil service procurement process.
And their typewriters. Listen, we've managed to get 4 years of shite out of this podcast.
Did they
listen to it? Maybe they will.
People really want to listen to how they had to go out and get three tenders because the contract for the typewriters was above £500, and they, this is premium content.
But it's linked to the disappearance of Aon Cloath Gaelic from signposts and other things, and we all know everyone loves talking about signage.
I love signage. I'll talk about signage in the case come up. But let's not talk about... We don't need to talk about De Walder's dictionary. We need to be looking to the future. We need to be looking at Ominon's dictionary. Because what's in Ominon's dictionary? But...
What is it, Pop Up Gaelic? Tell us.
Yes, so this is right.
Your boy's in the dictionary. Pop Up Gaelic is... It's official. It's official, Tommy. It's a folklore. It's in there.
You're legitimised now. Your legacy is complete.
We are absolutely delighted to see that Pather and Oscar's work has been recognised by the 2020 folklore. I'm absolutely thrilled for you both that you got this level of acknowledgement. And my idea was that we would do a series of episodes on the evolution of the folklore in the last 100 years to show how we got to the stage where you can finally be included in it.
Because this is obviously the pinnacle. Like, this is the language
is
peaked.
All other dictionaries
now
can stop. Hold the presses, guys. Pop-ups in the dictionary. That's it. The words are finished now.
No more words are required. Gurma, okay.
That is is so cool, though. I'm really proud of you guys. Like, it's unsurprising, really, because, like, it is so ingrained in, like, Gael lexicon now. Like, it's part of the lexicon. When you talk about the pop-up, everyone knows what you're talking about. When you talk about the pop-up in English, they're like, is there a new Vietnamese pop-up store in the ILAC Center? No, it's the pop-up Gaeltacht. That's what you're talking about. So it's unsurprising in a sense, but it's just super cool to see it right there in print on the pages of the dictionary. Not that I think that dictionaries legitimize words, because there's so many words that are in popular lexicon that aren't necessarily in a dictionary, and that's a politicized thing in itself, but it's still really cool.
It's still cool, though. Yeah, it is. Yeah. I agree with you 100%. Like, it's not the legitimization we craved. Like, that's not what this is about at all. But it's nice. It's good. And it's sort of representative of how great dictionaries are. They don't give things a seal of approval, but they are representative of what's out there. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty cool.
Yeah. And it's really cool to have that recording of it now, and that's... you know, forever there when you're dead and gone. No, sorry, I didn't mean to get grim on it. But like
Eileen Duvney Hunnell, exactly. We will never die. We will never die.
And on that note, I want to thank you both for joining me for this discussion of Queen Artilera and related topics, including A4 paper and powder getting in the dictionary. And so until the next time, it's a slán from me.
It's a slán from you.
And a slán from me.
Hey, it's Derek again. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. We are delighted and honored that you join us every Friday and that you welcome us into your headphones. We're just delighted that we get to keep making this show.
It's Garodin again. I just want to also say thanks so much to Kirsten Cheele for doing the artwork, and Brian for making us sound professional when we're not. Thanks so much, Brian. We appreciate it.
You can get the podcast anywhere that you get podcasts, but you can get in touch with us at motherfucklordheadstuff.org. And if you want to support the podcast and get access to unique and exclusive chats with guests, Q&As with content creators, and even discounts for some of Kirsten Cheele's amazing art and so much more, you can subscribe at patreon.com/Derek. And if you're not interested in having monthly payments going out of your bank account or your PayPal, you can actually get a massive discount, 16%, if you subscribe annually. That option is available, patreon.com/Derek. Gormila Mogli.
This has been a production of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
I want to say no one talked about A4 paper, Derek. You shoehorned that in like you shoehorned in Drasheen. Lads, do you know what that Zencaster doesn't take fathers? You don't know my pain.